Good morning and welcome to Coastal Conversations here on WERU. We explore issues facing Maine's coastal communities through dialogue with people who live, work, and play on our coast. From fisheries to tourism, from energy to environment, from economy to ecology, we go beyond the social media soundbites, probing deeply into complex issues and solutions. Coastal Conversations is supported by Maine Sea Grant in partnership with Scudic Institute and the First Coast. Welcome to this month's episode of Coastal Conversations.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Coastal Conversations. I'm your host, Catherine Devine of Scudic Institute. In this episode, I'm airing a conversation I had with Nicole Rogers, professor in the School of Forest Resources at University of Maine. Something that you probably don't know is I am a Giro Fellow in Science Communication at Scudic Institute. Part of my fellowship has been working on different projects to bridge the gap between the research done at Scudic Institute and the public. During the fellowship, I started thinking a lot about what happens to the research after it's completed. How is it applied? How does this impact our lives and the health and longevity of our natural world? And I became really interested in this topic because I just don't think this is talked about enough. What happens to the research when the research is done? To answer this question, I sat down with Nicole and she let me pick her brain a bit. Nicole is working on a research project that is affiliated with Scudic Institute called Extreme Climate in Trees. You may have heard of this research project a couple Coastal Conversations episodes ago when Jay Wason was on, who's also on the project. And what's unique about this project is not only is the research supposed to help understand how the northern forest will respond to extreme climate events, but the project also works hand in hand with land managers to help develop a response plan. And I was very interested in what does a response plan actually look like. So with that context in mind, I'd like to jump in to my conversation with Nicole Rogers, professor at the School of Forest Resources at University of Maine. Let's get into it.
My name is Nicole Rogers. I'm the Assistant Professor of Silviculture in the School of Forest Resources at the University of Maine, and I have my undergraduate from UMaine. I'm a Maine native. I've been a few other places in between, but have spent most of my personal life and my career here in the Northeast.
Awesome. Yeah, and then could you just give me a quick rundown, like what does forest management typically look like? Like what are the options for forest managers?
Well, that's a great question. Unfortunately, there is no short answer to that one. When I'm teaching my classes at UMaine and I'm talking with students about forest management and about silviculture, our default answer is always, it depends. Because so much of the decisions we make are going to be guided by things like what is in the forest? What do the landowners want? Are there any health concerns? Are there things like climate change we're trying to plan for? But it really comes down to, in its simplest form, trying to help the forest reach the objectives of the landowner, whoever that may be. And sometimes that's cutting trees, but other times that means not doing anything, just letting the forest do what it's already doing and keeping a watchful eye out. So the answer, that's a long-winded answer, but I guess that's because there's just so much complexity around managing forests, especially in a place like the Northeast.
Yeah, and so the goal of managing a forest isn't always to like minimize the impacts of climate change. It's anything from like if it's owned by someone who uses the land for timber, it could be about making sure that they have like the most bountiful like harvest essentially? Is that like?
Yeah. Yeah. So it could be like on a strictly production end, it might be things like, how do I generate the most trees to help me produce 2x4s that will end up in Home Depot or Lowe's? But it could also be things like, I really want bird habitat. How do I make sure that my forest is supporting those sort of wildlife communities? Or it could be things like, there's a researcher at the University of Maine who's considering forest management as a way to minimize ticks and the impact of Lyme disease. So it really can run the gamut. Or it could even just be things like, I really want my forest to look aesthetically pleasing. What does that mean? And so all of that interfaces with what humans want. And that's where it gets maybe more challenging to put a simple label on it, because how I define a beautiful forest might be really different than how you do or how someone down the street does, you know, so it can be a really wide range. And in a place like Maine, where we have so many private landowners, that just adds this level of complexity that I find really interesting. But again, it makes it challenging when we try and put a simple label on what is forest management and what are our objectives.
Yeah, that makes sense. And do you know like the demographic makeup of the like landowners?
So it really varies by region. For us in the Northeast, a lot of our stakeholders are private landowners, and that can be people like, my parents own 10 acres in Belfast, so they would fall in that category. And then it would be people like the big forest industry companies that own thousands and thousands or millions of acres. So when we say private, it can really run that spectrum. It could be, if you wanted to break that down further, it might be private family ownerships would be on the smaller end, say, and then private forest industry would be on the bigger end. So that's the key sort of demographic, is private ownership, but again, the spectrum there. And then within that, we also have ownership by state agencies like the Maine Forest Service or the Bureau of Parks and Lands. There can be federal ownership, whether that's national forests or national parks like Acadia, or over in the White Mountains, they have the White Mountain National Forest. And then in other places in the United States, the federal ownership footprint gets larger. So you might have, like out in the Pacific Northwest, a lot more federal ownership. And then you can have land trusts or nonprofits or conservation groups, things like that, who also have a stake in the forest and how we manage and play a role in that ownership demographic.
And Jay mentioned, and Nick mentioned, what's kind of unique about this study is that you guys are trying to incorporate these stakeholders like throughout the process.
Yeah.
Who are those stakeholders and what does that look like?
Sure. So that's a wide group again. And Jay was really intentional about that when he was putting this project together. And I think it's important because when we're talking about the coastal spruce ecosystem, which is the core of this work, we know a lot about spruce management in the interior portion of New England. It's one of our key commercial species. It's got really important value ecologically. So we have spent a lot of time as a forestry community thinking about how to manage red spruce. But this portion of the coastal spruce environment along Maine's coastline, and we know it extends beyond that, but for this study, we're focusing on the Maine coastline, has been sort of left out of that research endeavor for a long time because it's just different enough that it doesn't really fit the mold of the interior red spruce. And so along the coast, a lot of those stakeholders are again going to be private owners. It tends to be more the smaller landowners, because if you think about the coast of Maine, it's going to be, you know, individual families who have a chunk of land there. And so some of those folks are represented in this study. Jay has also reached out and worked with local land trusts as well and state agencies too, because they'll own things like islands along the coast that are acting as reserve space for these forests. And so we wanted to have all of those people represented, because if we're thinking about management implications, part of the challenge of getting any management adapted is making sure it's something people are comfortable with. And so before we put out some management guidelines and have people say, hey, wait a second, I have no interest in doing this, it made sense to us to integrate their feedback early on and get a sense of what they value and what they see as important, so that when we're making decisions about or recommendations about how these forests could be promoted and sustained in the future, we know that we'll have some buy-in from the folks who actually own the land, steward the land, manage the land.
Right. And so these like small landowners, have they vocalized like any concerns they have that, or like changes that they see, or like what is incentivizing them to participate?
That's a great question. So again, it always depends. Right. But part of it is people in Maine, I found, have a really strong connection to their forest land. And so even if they aren't, say, formally trained in forestry or forest ecology, they spend a lot of time in their woods and they notice when things are changing. And they may not be able to put a name on it, or they may not have the scientific term, but they can see when things are changing. And so our hope with engaging these folks is that they are connected to their forest land and that they have buy-in because they want to keep their forest healthy. They want to keep it as forest and they want to see it stay as forest into the future. And so our concern with red spruce and climate change is that the Gulf of Maine is warming so rapidly and these forests may be shifting and moving and changing in response to that. And we need to have management solutions that allow people, if their goal is to maintain coastal red spruce, tools that are specifically available to them so that they can do that.
You're listening to Coastal Conversations on WERU at 89.9 FM and streaming online at weru.org.
And we're back with Nicole Rogers, professor in the School of Forest Resources at University of Maine.
And so do you think do you think like the primary goal for a lot of these landowners, from what you can tell, is to just maintain the red spruce like population?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure from landowner to landowner if they would articulate it that way, like if their concern is about a singular species, but I would suspect a lot of them would say things like, I want my forest to be healthy. And so again, every landowner is different. But having big disturbances like windstorms come in that knock down a bunch of trees, or having some sort of invasive insect or disease come through that's killing a lot of their trees, I suspect they would recognize that as a concern and as something that's damaging the health of the forest. And so most often when I talk to individual landowners and say, you know, what's your objective here? What do you want out of your forest? They say forest health. And that can look really different depending on who you are, but the consensus seems to be that it's keeping that forest moving forward in its forest development trajectory and keeping the forest intact, keeping the trees looking vigorous. Those sorts of things come up a lot.
And where did this fit within the RAD framework? Like, resist, accept, direct.
Yeah. So that's a really excellent tool for helping us think about different directions that a forest could go. And so in Maine, we're really lucky because forests, they're just here. They do a really great job of regenerating themselves, maintaining themselves, and continuing on into perpetuity, whether people are involved or not. And so is this a resist climate change, adapt? It can go in a few different ways. For folks who are interested in keeping their forest just looking healthy and continuing to, you know, put on volume or continuing to regenerate new trees, new seedlings, maybe they're not resisting climate change, but they're looking to just continue on with the status quo. And so part of this could be helping them figure out how to keep the forest that they're familiar with, that they're comfortable with, into the future. So that doesn't necessarily feel like resistance to me, because resistance sometimes implies like head in the sand, I'm not going to acknowledge this is happening, but more just about keeping something that they're comfortable with, keeping something they're familiar with. And then in terms of the adaptation, I think that's where you really have a lot of flexibility, because we don't know what adapted forests really look like. We can have a sense, and there's some science that's coming out and telling us things like, maintaining lots of different species is really helpful. And our forests want to have a lot of different species, mm-hmm. because we don't know which ones are going to get hit with some new disease or some new insect. Mm-hmm. So maintaining species diversity can be a great tool. Other things like maintaining lots of different size classes in the forest could be a good tool, because sometimes, say a windstorm is going to come through and knock out the biggest trees, but the trees that are underneath that canopy might be able to hang on for a long time. And so For this work, I think it's about not putting all of our eggs in one basket, if you want to use that cliche, just having a variety of different management options for people that are anywhere along that spectrum. Do I want the status quo, or am I looking to the future and trying to figure out what my forest might be doing in the context of climate change? So we're really open to what sort of guidelines and recommendations we can make. And part of how we're going to make those decisions and how we're going to pull together those tools for landowners is just getting an assessment of the resource, which is the first phase of this work. Where are these forests? What do they look like? Are they healthy? What do they need to regenerate? And hopefully with that information, we'll be able to place ourselves more within this RAD framework so that people can sort of align with their personal values and figure out where they want their forest to go.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So as far as like what actually it takes to maybe like to manage a forest for someone's specific goals, what does that actually take? Like, would that be physically taking trees from somewhere else and transplanting them, or like what are the possibilities? And there's probably so many answers, but just maybe like a few examples.
Sure. There are so many answers, and my students always get frustrated with me about this too, because I'm always just saying, well, I don't know. It depends. It depends. Yeah. But part of it could be thinking about species from other places and moving them here and planting them in our forest, acknowledging that maybe in 100 years, something from, I don't know, Virginia that couldn't have thrived here before climate change now can. And so that strategy is called assisted migration. And there are a lot of folks that are looking at that in the Northeast. Other things might be planting species that have always been here, but that are struggling to regenerate now as the conditions are changing. And so in places like the Southern United States or in the Pacific Northwest, planting is a big part of what they do in terms of forest management. We haven't done much of it here in the Northeast. We just haven't had to. Our forests regenerate really well. If you create an opening in the forest, trees will always come back. We don't have to do much. We might manipulate the forest to get certain species or to help them grow better, grow faster, but they'll always come back. And so some of the strategies we're thinking about now might be just planting of native species because they're struggling to get started. Those little tiny seedlings, they need a lot of help to get up and moving. And if we have a big drought in the summertime and they need rain to get their roots down and start pulling some water up through the soil, they may not be able to make it. So part of it could be things like planting. Other things could be acknowledging that the growing season is getting hot and dry, or when we do have rain, it's coming in these big downbursts. So some strategies that folks have talked about too, it's called thinning. So it's like what you do in your garden. If you have too many little carrots, for example, and you go through and you pull out a couple and say, I only want, you know, 10 here. I don't want 100. We can do the same thing in our forest. We can thin out trees. And the idea is to leave trees behind that look healthy and vigorous. They have good crowns. We expect they're going to continue to grow. And also by doing that, you free up more resources. So instead of having 100 trees on 1 acre, maybe you have 75, and those 75 trees now have access to more resources than if all the trees had been there. So there are some strategies like that that we can also implement. And then I think it's just also spending time in the forest and keeping an eye out for signs of decline, because we know that the Northeast is a hotbed for insects and diseases. We see it all the time. And so monitoring, just keeping an eye out, are things changing and why? So that if we do have a problem come in, we know about it sooner rather than later, and we can develop some strategies to keep that forest healthy.
Yeah, and I'm sure that plays in with involving stakeholders during the study. Is this a unique ask? Like, is this sort of like a unique thing in like research in general? Is it normally more segmented? Like, it's like you do the study and then publish it and then like hope like a forest manager reads it? Or like, how does that normally work? Is this unique?
Yeah, sure. So there are definitely a lot of examples of that model you just described. Like, a scientist comes up with an experiment, implements it, puts it in a journal, and then hopes that someone reads it. But more and more, I'm seeing people considering this alternative model that Jay and others have promoted. And I'm finding it to be really helpful. So another project that I'm involved in, we're writing a new, it's called the Silviculture Guide for Northern Conifers in the Northeast. And we also are following this model, and we're a little bit further along in the process. We started a couple of years before Jay's work. And so I've seen the impact of stakeholders come in just over a longer period of time. And it really, it's such a collaborative process, and it makes the science better, because we as scientists have great ideas all the time, but we need people to help us think about the application. So I could come up with the very best scientific experiment and the very best way of managing a forest, but if it logistically doesn't make sense for a landowner, it's going to cost them too much money, or they can't find the operator that they need to implement my very perfect experiment, right? Then it doesn't go anywhere. So I think more and more people are recognizing that engaging stakeholders early on helps keep the sideboards on, so that the end product really is something that people can use. And also, the people that have been involved in this project and other stakeholder-driven projects I've been involved in, they really care about their forests. And that kind of passion makes these projects so much stronger. And also, people will come up with great ideas that I might not have considered ever. And so to hear someone who's been on their family forest for years, and their parents were on it before them and the generations before them, that kind of institutional information is really helpful as we're thinking about how to make something a tool, a communication piece that people really can use and that really will help them.
Wait, I'm sure. And so do you see sort of the future of forest management taking on this more like collaborative structure?
Yeah, I think a good forester always knows to check in with people, always knows that communication is key. And, you know, there are some jokes about foresters and forestry researchers being more introverted. All we want to do is spend time in the woods. But I think anyone who's been around for a while will tell you that communication is central to really doing our jobs well. And so there are definitely people who've been aware of that and working on being good communicators for a long time. But I am seeing a lot more of these collaborative projects, and I hope that they'll continue because the value is just really strong there.
Yeah, it sounds, that makes complete sense. Do you know of any of these like private landowners that like the land has been in the family for generations and they really care about like the health of their forest?
I definitely know people that fit in that category. If I can come up with their names off the top of my head, I'd be really impressed with myself. Yeah, there are a few folks for sure. And it will be interesting. Some of those people, they're not going to say climate change is their concern. Some might, but I would bet more often than not, that will not be the first phrase that comes out of their mouth. It will be other things like, you know, the crowns of my trees look kind of yellow all the time and they don't look very healthy, or it doesn't seem like my trees are growing the way they used to, or gosh, it's getting awfully dry out here and I'm finding lots of little dead trees in the summertime. So you may hear language like that instead that we can pull together and see as part of the climate change component. But usually climate change is not the first concern that people bring up, even if that's what's going on.
Two things, like one, like that was surprising for me, but I think that's also just like the bubble I live in. Two is that I guess in a way that's kind of like sweet to hear, because it's like it feels like they care so much about their land and these trees that it's like, it feels more personal almost, where they're like, mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's this really nice, idea. I'm not sure if idea is the right word, but interwoven thought that comes from some of the main tribes that was just brought to my attention recently, which is when they're talking about their forest, they think about it as their family. They don't think about it as managing a resource. For example, they're thinking about it as caring for their family members. And I love that idea so much. And I think it really typifies so many of the small woodland owners that I know or that I've worked with, this idea of like, this is a family of people or individuals or organisms that I'm caring for. It's so much more than just like trees for timber production, which has a place in Maine. I don't want to knock that at all. That has a place. But I love this idea of such a strong connection to your land that it feels like caring for a family.
Wait, that's so sweet. Have you read Braiding Sweetgrass?
No, it's on my nightstand. It's my next book.
Wait, I'm reading it now, and that's like very similar to a lot of the ways she describes like the land. But yeah, totally. It's like really interesting because I spent the last 5 years in New York City.
Oh wow.
And a lot of the themes I've been exploring is like sort of like this like connection with the land. I kind of like learned about this concept of like slow birding, which is like not birding. It's like people who bird without a checklist or without even really a lot of knowledge about the birds, but they it's just like this active attention and like observation.
Yeah.
And it's just been really cool for me to get exposed to all this stuff and sort of practice it as well, because it is crazy, like living in a more urban environment, the disconnect that I feel towards things. Like climate change is like this very abstract like concept.
Yep.
People here, I feel like, have such a, and probably it is like growing up surrounded by nature, like have such like a connection to the land that they feel like
And you know, things shifted with COVID, right? Like we had a lot of people move to Maine for a variety of circumstances. But prior to that, the influx of new people was slow. And so you've had these families that have been here for what feels like forever. And so there's just this long lineage of your family caring for land. And so it's just like an embedded part of who you are almost. And so that does give people a lot of attention and just care for land that maybe wouldn't happen in other places where people are newer to that space or don't have that sort of family heritage that goes along with it. And it's really fascinating, and it really does drive how people think about managing their forest in a way that I haven't seen in other places I've lived.
Thank you so much, Nicole Rogers. And thank you for tuning in. I'm your host, Catherine Devine of Skudik Institute.
Thank you for tuning in to this month's episode of Coastal Conversations. Join us on the fourth Friday of each month at 4 p.m. for information, stories, and conversations about the issues and people of the Maine coast. That great music you're hearing in the background is called A Following Sea and was composed and performed by Paul Anderson. On behalf of Maine Sea Grant and in partnership with Skudik Institute and the First Coast, we wish you a good weekend.